Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. We've probably all known or heard about a bride who went overboard, who lost perspective and became impossible in the run-up to her wedding. Reality television is full of bridezillas, but at Craig Bridger's wedding, the tables were turned. Here's John Cho. He plays Hikaru Sulu in the most recent Star Trek reboot, reading Craig's essay, Men Don't Care About Weddings, Groomzilla is Hurt.
I'm not the type of guy who would want to plan a wedding. I would rather play Xbox than watch Say Yes to the Dress. I don't know if I'm a fall or a summer. I decorated our bathroom with a framed Batman comic book. But I found myself engaged to a wonderful woman who is so overbooked and so chronically late that she has her own time zone. We call it Terra time. I knew I had to step up if I wanted to make it down the aisle. And when I did, something unrecognizable began to stir inside me. Everyone knows about Bridezilla, the toothy creature in a wedding dress whose apocalyptic meltdowns send bystanders running for cover. But I'm here to tell you there is a far more terrible beast lurking in the matrimonial jungle. Fear him, for he is among us. His name is Groomzilla. And at my wedding, he was me. It all started with a tie dilemma. I can see that now. I wonder if Groomzilla could have been stopped then, if I could have killed him in the shell, as Brutus proposed to do to Caesar, had I only known. Listen, I do not wear ties unless I need one for an audition. I'm an actor and a writer. What I'm trying to say is, I'm a bartender. So I have never thought much about ties. I have never noticed them in stores or on necks. But not long after my fiancé and I finally settled on a date, ties began to haunt me. I started to see them in my sleep. When I slept, which I didn't, because I was always lying awake thinking about ties. As it turns out, New York is a city teeming with ties. And none of them looked right for my wedding. Tara, logging 12-hour days, teaching and studying Pilates, had no time for my sartorial crisis. I had nothing but a skinny swatch from her champagne-colored sash and my own waffling sense of fashion to guide me. So I did the only sensible thing. I bought every champagne tie I liked everywhere and took them all home. I bought ties from Bloomingdale's, Macy's, Barney's, Banana Republic, and one from Paul Stewart that cost almost as much as my wedding band. At home, I held them up to my throat, fanned them out on the table like a silken royal flush, and wondered just what was happening to me. But my obsession went beyond ties. When it came to writing the invitations, the wedding programs, and those little save-the-date cards, vanity didn't get me into trouble. Ego did. Tara played my ego like a well-tuned kazoo. "Baby, you're such a good writer," she would tell me via cell phone, on a breathless break between clients and class. "You're so good with words." And suddenly, I would be back at the computer, birthing tumescent phrases like, "Under the setting sun, Tara and Craig will at last be wed. I agonized over whether to quote A Midsummer Night's Dream or Romeo and Juliet on the response card. And then I agonized over whether to use a semicolon or comma in said quote, because frankly, many Shakespeare authorities disagree on that. I hadn't asked for the job, but now that it was mine, I was determined to write pure wedding poetry. Tara and I settled into a pattern. I would tease out a brilliant idea, and she would come home and veto it, which would only feed my blooming hysteria. True, she often had a point. For instance, maybe it was tacky to format the invitation like a movie poster and write that our wedding was produced by God Almighty. But still, she didn't have to tell me that. The creative process is a delicate thing. And when she would critique my genius, I would immediately grow resentful. Why was I stuck writing the ooey-gooey stuff? I'm a dude. It insulted my dignity, like training a cat to wear a mouse on its head. And I never received credit for my labors anyway. After I created an email account for our wedding and sent out a custom-made, and I might add fabulous, save-the-date e-card, I was flooded with replies praising Tara, who was in England with her mother, for the delightful message. Right up to the wedding, some guests continued to respond to my email messages by writing to Tara, even though I signed them all Craig. People just couldn't fathom that the groom, not the bride, might be leading our frantic march to I Do. When we were first engaged, I was advised by friends to nod and stay out of Tara's way. And despite the fact that more and more grooms are now very involved in wedding planning, the traditional wisdom remains that a groom, like a child, should be seen and not heard. Real men, the logic goes, don't care about weddings. And that hurts Groomzilla. That makes him cry. But only on the inside. He doesn't want to streak his self-tanning lotion. Months after the ceremony, in my desperate search for answers, I called Dr. Kathleen Gerson, a sociology professor at New York University, and asked her why some of the wedding chores made me feel emasculated. I don't like that term, she told me. Emasculate implies that there's only one way to be a man. Oh. I didn't tell her that being swiftly corrected when trying to use big words like emasculated also makes me feel emasculated. I felt better, though, when I asked her if she thought I was a wimp. You are absolutely not a wimp, she said. You're the opposite of a wimp. You're a pioneer. Woohoo! That's more like it. A pioneer. A frontiersman in an unmapped gender wilderness. I wish I had known Dr. Gerson before the wedding. Then again, imagining myself as a rugged adventurer wouldn't have crossed anything off my towering to-do list. It wouldn't have lowered my blood pressure. Overstressed and underappreciated, I staggered toward my wedding weekend like, well, an overgrown lizard swatting buildings and planes from his furious path. Tara and I fought whenever someone said the word wedding. I resented her busy schedule and her carefree attitude. She resented my acting like a jerk. I skulked around our apartment, dragging my tail across the wooden floor, bellowing about everything from gift registries to whether the groomsmen should escort the bridesmaids down the aisle. But when I sounded my reptilian roar at my soon-to-be sister-in-law, I had gone too far. Oh, I could make excuses. I might mention that I had scrambled to gather the wedding license, the rings, the programs, the music and the gifts for the bridal party. I could point out that I had played tour guide on a bus that my father chartered to take the out-of-town guests from New York City to Chappaqua, where Tara and I arrived too late for our scheduled meeting with the minister. And after all that, with minutes to go before we had to be at the rehearsal, I just wanted to go to the bathroom. But there they were. Tara and Natalie, my fiancé and her sister-in-law, standing in the bathroom doorway, chatting. I stood on one foot, and then the other. I waited for them to notice me, and then I lost it.
How about you get out of the way and shut the door so I can have a little privacy?
I shouted.
How about that?
When I saw the disgust on Natalie's face, I realized what I'd done. Moments later, in the bathroom mirror, the ugly truth grimaced back at me. Scales. Claws. The thick-lidded eyes of a beast. In a way, my shameful outburst saved me. I didn't want to be that thrashing, tense creature at my own wedding. I started to breathe. Things weren't going to be perfect. And with my bride anyway, they weren't going to happen on time. Just acknowledging this fact helped exorcise Groomzilla. Sometime in the night, he turned his gnarled back to the world and lumbered out to sea, leaving me neurotic, nervous, but whole. And on the big day, even though I had to wait an hour for Tara, standing in the sun in my sharp black suit, while the photographer took some pre-ceremony pictures, I felt fantastic. Someone handed me a glass of wine. I looked at my mom and dad, the arriving guests, the people I love. And when my bride appeared in the doorway, everything else, the stress, the tantrums, the petty details, the shocking price tag, melted away. I was getting married. It has been 3 months now, and Groomzilla is just an embarrassing memory. A lot of people told me our wedding was the best they had ever been to. Is that just something you're supposed to say, like telling your Aunt Clara, that was the best liver I've ever tasted? I don't know. It certainly was the best day of my life. But sometimes, late at night, I'm still plagued with doubt. Maybe I should have gone with the Paul Stewart tie.
John Cho reading Craig Bridger's essay, Men Don't Care About Weddings, Groomzilla is Hurt. We'll hear from Craig after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to The New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. When we sat down with Craig Bridger, we immediately wanted to know, what was it like when he first told the world he was a groomzilla?
I was an actor at the time, and I was in rehearsals for a production of Measure for Measure. And this was probably about 2 weeks after the story was published. We were on a break from rehearsal, and I just was chatting with my friend Carter. And Carter mentioned that he was recently engaged. You know, we were just getting to know each other as the early stages of rehearsal. And I said, oh, you know, I got married not too long ago. And we were commiserating about the stresses of the wedding planning. And I mentioned that I had taken on a lot of the wedding planning myself. And he said, oh, man, you have to read this story. A friend of mine just forwarded me this. You're going to love this. This guy wrote this whole story about how he had to plan his own wedding and sort of turned him into a groomzilla. And I said, yeah. I wrote that.
Craig says there were lots of weird moments like this one. And then there were the agents, and a book deal, and a call from Hollywood. But
it's been a long time since I wrote that story. It's been a long time since I got divorced. So I don't think about that time much anymore. And those wounds have mostly healed. It's comfortably in the past at this point, let's put it that way.
And when our producer Jessica Alpert called Craig, he almost didn't go through with this interview.
Because, frankly, it's a little embarrassing. And, of course, it was embarrassing to be the groomzilla to begin with and write that story. And that was kind of the point of it. You know, I don't mind a little bit of self-deprecating humor, and it was ridiculous. But I think what redeems the story for me, or what redeemed it at the time, was that, you know, at the end of the day, I got married and, you know, it's a happily ever after sort of ending. And I think what I jump to is this fear that someone who doesn't know me is going to read the story or hear the podcast and think, well, you know, of course, you know, a type A jerk who tries to plan his wedding. Of course that didn't work out. But when I thought more about it, you know, what rose to the top for me was that this was a really important event in my life, not just the wedding, of course, and the marriage, and will always be part of my history, but also the platform that Modern Love gave me and the opportunity to write that story and share it with people. And it is still funny, and it is still something I'm proud of, separate from, you know, what happened a few years down the line.
Despite that emotional detour, life's good for Craig. He recently moved back to Los Angeles after spending 15 years in New York. He says it feels good to be back home on the West Coast.
And today, my love life consists of, like everyone else, a lot of swiping left and swiping right out here in L.A. There's this false idea that these apps give us, especially if you're in a big city, that you have an infinite number of people. And why would you even bother to start to invest in one when there's this infinite potential waiting for you at home as soon as you get the phone out again? And I think that's really insidious, and I think it works on you even in an unconscious way. I just remember, you know, it wasn't so long ago that if you met somebody at a party or at a bar or wherever and something kind of clicked, you'd be so excited that you kind of had a spark with somebody that you would definitely follow that. But now you go, well, that was cool. I wonder what's going on with, you know, these 500 other matches that I can swipe through tonight, you know? I'm not sure what it's doing to our mating rituals, but it can't be good. So we're all collecting baseball cards of each other online.
Craig Bridger. His book is Surviving Groomzilla, A Bride's Guide. He works for a Scotch whiskey supplier and lives in Los Angeles. In a moment, we'll hear from Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for The New York Times. John Cho has some thoughts, too. Stick around.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Daniel Jones is editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times. He says it's pretty difficult to write a modern love essay that's truly funny.
A lot of readers I've discovered with that kind of essay really fear for the writer. You know, they go overboard with their concern. And instead of finding it funny, they think the person, you know, is verging on mental illness. It's really, really hard to pull off a modern love essay that's just comic. And Craig Bridger does that. It's one of the purest funny essays that we've ever run in the column.
Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. We asked actor John Cho why he chose to read this piece.
I guess I could relate to it. I'm turning into a bit of a dandy as I get older. Maybe it's the profession I'm in. But it was very well observed and inward-looking. And it was a moment of gender self-doubt as you're entering the most gender-affirming thing there is.
Thanks again to John Cho for reading this week's essay. His next film, Columbus, premieres at Sundance this weekend. Next week on the podcast, actor Michael T. Williams brings us the story of a father trying to connect with his autistic son.
He threw himself on the sand that was warm and fine and listened to the sound of the surf. It was as if he had finally found someone who spoke his language. The Pacific Ocean.
You may recognize that voice from the new film Fences. We recorded a Facebook Live event when Michael T. was in the studio. We'll link to that at wbur.org/modernlove. Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, and Amory Sievertson. Extra help this week from producer Catherine Brewer. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.